come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the most intriguing archaeological mysteries of all time is the location of Noah's Ark. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guests are two of the archaeologists who accompanied a really groundbreaking, I think, investigation and expedition several years ago, which has been documented and has now been released in a documentary film called Finding Noah. Want to find out some of the difficulties involved in this particular quest, and so it is our honor to welcome into the program Dr. Aaron Judkins and Bruce Hall. Welcome, both.
Hi, Derek.
Bruce, Aaron and I have talked a couple of times previously. This is our first time getting acquainted, so I'd like to ask a little about your background for the benefit of the audience. You look like you've got quite a diverse resume. Architect, pastor, and PhD candidate in biblical archaeology?
Yes, exactly right. I went through Texas A&M Architecture School and then went on to receive a Master's of Divinity from Southwestern Seminary, which is more of a pastor degree. So I've been a bivocational pastor for 21 years and work as an architect during the week. And then I felt like the Lord called me to go into biblical archaeology, and lo and behold, here we are.
Now, biblical archaeology is fascinating. Obviously, there have been some pretty important, financially rewarding movies that have been made about biblical archaeology, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What was it that attracted you to the field?
Well, ever since I was a young man, I had an uncle who was an amateur archaeologist, and we went out looking for Native American artifacts. So I grew up in the what's called the Yellow House Canyon near Lubbock, Texas. I grew up going out with him, so he instilled in me a love for archaeology, and my dad was an architect, so I went to school for architecture, and I had no idea some of the first archaeologists in the world were architects. So they're kind of sister professions, if you will, or they're sister degrees, because, you know, a lot of archaeology deals with ancient ruins of, ancient buildings. So as time progressed, and with my degree and my Master's of Divinity and my background in architecture, it just seemed like a fit to go into biblical archaeology, which has always been a fascinating for me. Even since, you know, as a kid, I was fascinated with the Noah's Ark story. So That's how it all came about.
I can see the correlation, I think, between investigating ruins and trying to figure out how the architects of, say, 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years ago constructed certain buildings. In your experience, Bruce, especially after this venture to Mount Ararat, how did your training as an architect help you in the field? In the field.
Well, I actually am what's called today a forensic architect, meaning I've spent most of the last 29 years studying buildings, and quite a few of them were historical buildings, such as the Alamo here in Texas and the Governor's Mansion here in Texas. So looking at buildings with some age on them, and then more of my specialty was the building envelope, keeping moisture out of buildings. And so the interesting part of all structures, be it boats or buildings, is they have to keep the weather out. You know, they're shelter for humans. And so bituminous materials, which just bituminous, just a big word, it means black gooey stuff that waterproofs. So I've spent most of my career in laboratories and working with other engineers and architects studying ancient bituminous materials, and then, of course, modern-day bituminous materials, which help help in the study. So going to look for Noah's Ark fit right into what I'm doing because, as you know, in the biblical narrative, it says that the boat was swabbed with Noah's pitch or some type of a pitch. What's interesting is in the industry, there's actually a manufacturer who makes a pail of black gooey stuff, and he calls it Noah's pitch. So I think that's pretty neat. But that's how I got into all this, and it's been a wild ride, and I've enjoyed getting to hang out with my buddy Aaron Judkins. So it's been funny.
Aaron, I'm going to bring you into the conversation here in just a minute, but Bruce, I'd like to ask you first, how did you get connected with this expedition?
Well, mainly through Dr. Randall Price. He and I have been friends for about 10 years now, and he was working in Qumran, and I wanted to work with him in Qumran. That's near the Dead Sea, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And so we knew each other, and I was working in Gezer. I had to do that for my PhD, and he kept inviting me to come to Qumran and work with him, and I couldn't. And then through a course of conversation, he mentioned to me that he was involved in looking for Noah's Ark. And I said, great, I would love to do that. And one thing led to another, and next thing you know, we're planning a trip together to climb that big giant rock pile and look for Noah's Ark under the ice cap. So that's how it all came about for me.
Well, we're going to have an opportunity to meet Dr. Price next July. He's going to be one of the speakers at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, which I will be attending as one of the members of Skywatch TV. So we're looking forward to talking with him, and I'll have to make sure to ask him about that. I wanted to ask him about the location of the Third Temple, since that's such a hot geopolitical topic right now. But we'll hold off on that until we have the opportunity to sit down with him. Aaron, your involvement in this film, what was it that drew you into this project?
Well, back in 2010, I was kept apprised with the current research that was going on and was invited to go on the expedition 5 years ago. And, you know, either you have time and no money or money and no time. In my case, it was both. I had neither. So I wasn't able to go. I had to pass. But I just said, you know, I'm interested in what you're doing. I knew Dr. Price was on the project. And I wanted to just keep informed about the latest research going on. It was, I guess, back in 2013, in the spring, I was speaking at a high school in Houston. They had me back for the third annual time to come teach the students for, I think that was my third year in a row to go. And I was there with one of the researchers, Don Patton, who was also speaking there. And we happened to be rooming together for the time we were there that week. And so it gave us a good opportunity to catch up as he lives in another state. And I asked him, what's the current research? And he told me, and he asked me if I was what I was doing in August. Now, this is in March. And I said, well, I have no idea. He said, well, would you like to go with this? This is going to be the last major push to search for the Ark, and we need you. Can you go? And I said, absolutely, I'm there. Now, you have to understand, Derek, that, again, money and time plays an issue. And I had no idea how I was going to make that happen. I just basically spoke the words, you know, hoping and praying that somehow it would happen. And I just said, you know, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And if the Lord opens those doors for me, then great. But I really want to be able to go on this expedition because it's the last major push. And I knew how important this was. It was all hands on deck. And we need everybody on. So I thought, man, how am I going to do this working around my full-time schedule? How am I going to be able to afford to even go and spend that much time? You're talking, you know, almost 2 months away from home and several thousand dollars just to buy my ice equipment, my camping gear that you need. It's Arctic equipment. I don't have any of that stuff. I'm not a mountaineer, and I don't climb mountains for fun.
Not much salt for that down in Texas, I would imagine.
Right. I mean, I'll hike all day long. I'll be in the sand dunes and the deserts of the Southwest all day long, and I have. And I've camped in the Sinai Desert with the Bedouins. But climbing at 17,000 feet in eastern Turkey, that's a whole nother beast. And so because of the of some of the current talks I was in with some of the producers in Hollywood about doing a reality show on archaeology, one thing led to another, and Brent Baum, who is a film director in Hollywood, caught wind of the of our expedition. We were seeking not the film. Matter of fact, all of us signed on some 3 months before the film crew ever signed on for this expedition. So it's not like any one of us signed up because we knew there was going to be a film. It was, it didn't work that way. None of us knew, including myself, until some months later. But Don said, we're needing some funding. And, of course, every year is dependent on funding. And I said, well, what's your funding needs? Where are you at? And it was in the several hundred thousand dollar range.
Mm.
And I said, well, good luck, because I don't have it, you know. But, you know, if I can help, you know, I will. So through this whole process, in exchange for having this film made, and we didn't know it was a film. We just knew that there were going to be cameras, and we didn't quite know if it was going to be a documentary on History Channel or Discovery Channel. We had no idea it was going to be on film. But we just knew that they were going to be filming this. And we had, I say we, but in the expedition's past, they had another camera guy there with their own camera. So it's not unusual for all, you know, cameras and videography to be, you know, rolling at the, this is historic research. So we just accepted it. The funding came through, Derek, and it's like if you're the World Series was last night. I didn't watch it, but it's like hitting a grand slam in the World Series and winning the series. That's how this came through. And I never expected, after several meetings in Dallas, that this would go through. I thought something surely at the last minute would fall through, but it didn't. The Lord opened those doors and not only made a way for the expedition, but made a way for me to go. And so everything just opened up, and then in August, July, and in August in 2013, my life began to change as I began to go up that mountain. What an incredible experience.
Hmm. Bruce, how did this expedition compare to other digs that you've been involved with?
I would say this is the pinnacle of expedition. I can't imagine anything grander except maybe actually finding the Holy Grail. But, you know, the fact that they came down the mountain with some organic material to me was made the expedition all worth it, and, you know, just an outstanding time. I've done other archaeology projects at Gezer, and you know, it just, this is like this is the Secretariat of Archaeology. You know, it's like winning the Triple Crown. It's incredible. So I'm just thrilled that I was able to be a part of it, and thank God for it.
That part of the world, and I've been very much aware of this here recently as I track the news on a daily basis. That part of the world is in turmoil right now. And as I understand it, there was an excellent article about this expedition at the Hollywood Reporter. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I wasn't aware of this when you and I talked before, Aaron, or maybe it just slipped past me. But you all had to deal with a group that's officially designated a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. Bruce, what were your thoughts when you realized you were negotiating with guys who were considered a terrorist outfit?
Well, I really felt like, it's like what Randall Price says, when you're in the will of God, you know there's no other better place to be. You may not be in the safest environment, but you know you're carrying on with what needs to be done. So I didn't sit around thinking, you know, am I going to be shot today, even though that was a possibility. I was focused on doing the job we needed to do and praying that I could get on the plane and get out of there still alive, which, thank God, happened. But, you know, there were times and when we were in Dogavizet, which is the little town down the mountain that we were staying in, where you did feel like at any time trucks could roll in with a bunch of guys and jump out and take you hostage, and you may never see your family again and be a POW. Or, you know, worse things could have happened. Fortunately, I found out a pastor disappeared off the mountain 2 years before. I didn't know that story, or I think I'd been a little more nervous.
Hmm.
But, you know, that's just the kind of dangers you had to accept going into Turkey. And I think once I got to the hotel and saw Aaron and all the other guys and we were banded together, I had a little more confidence that this was actually going to work. Because you don't know. It's like Aaron said, you think it's just going to fall apart at the last minute and things aren't going to happen. But God put it all together, Derek, and made it where we shuffled up the mountain and were able to get something accomplished. And the movie was made, and it was amazing. You know, it was absolutely amazing that this all came about, and we're still talking about it, you know, 2.5 years after it happened.
Well, so, I can only imagine.
It's really neat.
I think we Americans have a false sense of security that we've developed from living in a country that's relatively peaceful, relatively safe compared to other parts of the world. We don't really understand when we travel, especially into areas like the Middle East, that the same rules don't necessarily apply. Aaron, what was going through the minds of the crew when you guys learned that the general in charge of that Kurdish militia group there wanted $600,000 to let you guys on the mountain?
Oh, well, how did you get that information, Derek? I want to know. That's inside information.
That was actually published by the Hollywood Reporter.
It is. No, yeah. Okay. I'm being facetious, actually. You know, that we did keep that under wraps until just recently. But you're right. There is dangers on that mountain. Part of our team, we left the summit and descended the mountain at different times. Part of that film crew was consisted of the director of the film and some of the camera guys and some of the other members on the team. Bruce and I were still on the summit, but we didn't know this has happened until we got down the mountain ourselves and we learned later. But part of what happened was the PKK, they're the freedom, the Kurdish freedom fighters, and they're fighting for an independent Kurdistan separate from Turkey.
Right.
And so there's historically been fighting between the Turkish military and the PKK. The PKK strategically control that mountain. You're just right next door to Iran. You're right next door to Syria. Russia's to the north of you. It's a very precarious geopolitical area. And they had erroneously heard that we had paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars to, you know, to someone so we could go do this. That was not true. Yes, we had to pay hundreds of thousands to fund the expedition, but that was for our needs. And some of that was to pay the local Kurdish people who helped carry our scientific equipment in our camping gear up the mountain. And of course, you know, there's several camps along the way and they feed you. And so, and you have to pay for the horses. Horses can only go up to 14,000 feet. And then from 14 to 17, that has to get all hauled up, on someone's back. So, but they had, captured, I say captured very loosely, but they, surrounded our team that descended the mountain first. And matter of fact, the guide, who was a little teenage Kurdish boy, recognized who they were and tried to skirt around them and could not, and became very, very nervous. And the team realized, the director told me, he said, "We realized something was wrong." And these guys come out of the rocks with machine guns. There's, I think Brent said there was about 40 of them. And they demanded their tax, a portion out of the, what they thought we had paid to someone else. And so they wanted tax out of that.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, they eventually convinced them we did not pay that. And there's, and even if we did, there was no money to be paid for $600,000. And so over a course of several hours, the situation was tense. However, one of the Kurdish guides that was with our team basically got them out of it. And he said, we have given our sons to you. Because, see, every male is required to go into the PKK. If you're a Kurdish of nationality, you're required to go in. There's not a choice. And he said, we have given freely our sons to your cause. Is this not a cause great enough that these people are our guest? These Westerners are our guest. And because of that, they said, you're right. And basically, they sat down together. And the tensions were basically broken at that time. They were finally released on their own free will, and they were left to go in peace. The director later said to the camera guys, "I can no longer keep you and promise your safety, so I'm releasing you from your contract. If you want to get on the plane and go home, now is your time." And not one man, not one person, Derek, chose to leave. They all stayed. And so that is a testament to the type of men that were on our team.
Hmm. Bruce, what was the most interesting discovery interesting aspect of the actual work on the mountain, the actual archaeology? What did you do that you found to be the most intriguing or perhaps even most the most exciting discovery?
Well, I was on what everybody referred to as the drill team, and it consisted of Will, Bill, and me. Will, a young man, and Bill's about my age. Anyway, we were running this gasoline-powered hand auger, and we had drilling sticks for cutting bores down through the 60-foot ice cap that were about 3-foot lengths. And so we would drill down 3 feet and then have to add another length and drill down. And while we were doing this, I came up with the idea, being from a laboratory background, that whatever came out of the hole, instead of waiting till I get down the mountain to test materials, go ahead and do a makeshift lab up on the mountain. So in our mess tent, I set up a little testing over a propane bottle, so that every time the different materials came out of the hole, I put them in a test pan, took them into the tent, and I heated them up. Essentially, what I was trying to do was you put heat to it. Of course, the ice is going to melt, and you can drain the water off, but the rocks are not going to melt. But anything that's organic in nature is either going to burn or melt or change some type of form.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me? So this is a very rudimentary test method, but it was something that we could, instead of having to take down large amounts of samples down the mountain, we could eliminate what's not of value. And long story short is out of 40 holes, we came up with two holes that produced organic samples. One of them, I accidentally, because I didn't have the heat geared right, I overheated the first one. It swelled up like a plum, a bubble, if you will. And if you saw Jurassic Park and you saw the mosquito and the little amber sap ball?
Yeah.
Remember that? Mm-hmm. It kind of looked like that, and then it popped and went all over my tray. And then the next time I found one in another hole, it started to heat up like that, and I was able to shut the heat off before it got large. And it's the one you see in the movie. Whenever you see the movie, you'll see that one. So anyway, we felt like, well, at least we came back with two organic samples. And when I say organic, the geologist is Dr. John Bryant. He is a Ph.D. in the field, and he said anything over 12,000 foot on a mountain or that's organic is interesting because you're above the tree line. And, of course, at 17,000 feet, it's really interesting because even most animals won't go up to the summit of this mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So to hit something like that, and, of course, for me, since these materials under a microscope kind of look like a resin, if you will, some type of a tree sap. It has an amber color to it. That's exciting for us for me as an archaeologist to hope that possibly these materials are Noah's pitch, the waterproofing of the ark. I even said I believe the first thing we'll hit before we hit wood would be some type of a resin or bituminous material. And in one of the samples, the one shown in the movie, there's actually some fibers in the sample. So we still have the sample. We have not gone to testing yet, but we're planning on, since the movie's now released, to go into a testing protocol to, testing's going to be very expensive to do the kind of tests that we want to do, and we were kind of all out of money. The money we believe, I've already had phone calls that the money will be there as soon as we get prepared to test. So that's where we're headed to now. That's what excites me in all this is coming back with those two organic samples.
Now, what was it that led you to choose that particular site to drill?
Well, that was really more Aaron and the other guys. They're in contact. Dr. Bryant and Dr. Price have been in contact with some gentlemen who were able to see the top of the mountain through with NASA type of equipment, personnel and equipment, being satellites and what have you, to see the top of the mountain to where you can penetrate the ice cap. And the reports were there's something rectilinear on the mountain under the ice cap that's not rock, it's not ice. And we can see it there. So that was the first. And I kind of like to describe this like you're doing a radio. You know how on the old radios you had a big dial to move things up and down? Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
And then once you found a station, then there used to be a fine tuner.
Right.
You know, so if you will, the satellites were our big tuner. And then our fine tuner is that Dr. Bryant brought up GPR equipment. Ground penetrating radar and put it on a sled. You'll also see that in the movie. In fact, you can see that in some of the trailers on the website. Human beings pulled the sled around with the equipment on it, and the GPR would take a sensor similar to a sonar would in a boat through the ice cap and bounce off data to help us determine where would be best to drill. And we basically came up with two different locations, and we ended up taking about 40 cores in those locations. So that's how we came from macro down to micro down to drilling. So it worked out well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Aaron, how would you describe the results or the findings to this point? I mean, knowing that you haven't tested those cores yet to find out what those organic samples actually are, what would you say you came down from the mountain with?
Well, it's interesting because Bruce is really the bituminous expert, and he thought they were worth saving and testing. And let me just say, had it not been for Bruce being up there and being diligent about what was coming out of that hole, you're talking, you know, samples that are large enough to hold in the palm of your hand, very, in some cases, very delicate. Bruce provided a critical role. Matter of fact, when you're up there, you have to fulfill probably two or three different roles at the same time. And this is certainly one that Bruce, in addition to being on the drill team, was a part of. And so this whole thing hinged on Bruce's findings of these samples. They went down the mountain. They went to a lab that we got permission in Dauga by Isaac. And in the film, you see them looking under the microscope, and it looks organic. They say it's amber. It looks like it's maybe translucent. And Bruce and I have talked about this at length, and we're very optimistic, but we don't know what it is. We can say with some, I think, high confidence that it's probably organic, but we don't know exactly what that is yet. And Bruce is in the process of, you know, getting those samples tested so we can see what those are. And that's interesting. I didn't think about hitting pitch first, if indeed that's what it is, before wood. And that, I guess, would make some sense if you are hitting the pitch and you are getting that off. The wood should be very hard if we hit it. It should just be like concrete. So is it possible that wood could exist on the mountain under the ice cap? Yes. And we have many examples of that in different conditions, environmental conditions, wood surviving 4,000 years. It's not out of the realm of possibility, and our hope was to hit wood. But these two organic samples that Bruce Hall brought down are very critical in understanding what's on the Eastern Plateau.
Now, how does this location, the Eastern Plateau, differ from other areas that have been examined by previous expeditions?
The previous expeditions have been on the Eastern Plateau with this research team, but not just on the Eastern Plateau. You have to understand that the arc is probably broken into three or maybe four different pieces now. Before 1840, historical accounts suggest that that structure was intact. In 1840, there was an earthquake in that region. It activated the volcano there on Greater Ararat, and it blew out the Ahura Gorge on the northeast side. That gorge killed 200 people that lived in a monastery about 7,000 feet down on the north side of the mountain. That was said to have some artifacts from Noah's Ark in that monastery, and it blew out the Ahura Gorge, which is deeper than the Grand Canyon. So we think the Ark is in three or four maybe different pieces, and it's very, very difficult to access the Ahura Gorge without dying. Matter of fact, that the gentleman that Bruce was referring to earlier was Randall McKenzie. He was from Scotland, and Donald McKenzie was trying to verify the claims of the Chinese back in 2010 that they found something, and he went missing on the mountain and is presumed dead. But we were in this particular area, in particular because we can't get on the Ahura Gorge side without much risk, and the permissions have to be obtained from the PKK, which were denied that year we were there. You have to go from the top, and then from the top you try to access the Ed Davis Valley, where Ed Davis in 1943 said he saw the remains of a structure. Ed Davis's account is probably one of the most credible modern-day eyewitness accounts. He passed three lie detector tests, and this was an area that since 1943, that valley has filled up with ice. So that's the area that we were in. Part of the ongoing research is, you know, to build upon what you know and what you don't know from this, from the expeditions and the science before. And part of that is ruling out the Eastern Plateau. And if we did nothing else on the 2013 expedition, we scientifically ruled out the Eastern Plateau. So either if it's us or another expedition team should ever go back to Greater Ararat and get permission to go, we had the exclusive permission the last 3 years running from 2013 prior to search for the Ark, then it's with reasonable assurity that it is not there and that it needs to be, the Hoar Gorge probably needs to be explored. But having said that, we know 40 places where it's not.
Bruce, you both had kind of mentioned that this was sort of a last shot, a last attempt. Is that because of the political situation or financial situation, or you know, what would prevent another expedition from going back there and digging a little deeper?
Well, I think it was the group of guys that had been working on it for 5 or 6 years were saying, you know, every archaeological team normally has a design of how long they're going to be on the mountain. You know, how long they're going to look for it, how many seasons. Like, I just finished Gezer, and Gezer was designed to be a 10-season search for different things. And the funny, people ask me, you know, about Noah's Ark and, you know, that we didn't actually find the Ark. And I said, well, we've been searching at Gezer for 10 years and haven't found what we were looking for. We were looking for the Amarna letters, and we didn't find them.
Uh-huh.
Does that mean our efforts were in vain? Well, no. We, like Aaron said, we have proven that where we searched, it's not there. So, you know, sometimes people look at things backwards. Every archaeological team, we have to go about things scientifically and with a method. And so when they said 2013 would be the last, they were talking about this particular group.
Okay.
Now, other groups are, you know, more than welcome to go and look. In fact, we hope that's what this movie does, is inspire people to get off the couch and go look for things, not particularly Noah's Ark, but if that's what God's called them to do, then yeah, sure. It takes a lot of money to do this, so not only do we need people to go, we need the guys who have the finances to fund it. Because, and that's one thing I hope to show with the samples I came home with, is to give a glimmer of hope that we've hit something on the mountain, be it an ark or what Dr. Bryant calls most likely a debris field, because, you know, arks have a tendency, or old wooden structures have a tendency to split up and break and what have you. So we may just be finding the remnants or a debris field, if you will. But regardless, we're trying to, like good archaeologists, come up with some substance that could be interpreted to be the pitch of the boat. Will we be able to say it is Noah's pitch? Not until we find a larger section and we're able to match the samples we found to the pitch that we find on the larger structure. Will we be able to say that we, in 2013, archaeologically found the first piece of Noah's Ark? Do you follow that?
Yeah.
Reasoning I went through there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, all you can say is that you found anomalous organic material at a level, at an altitude where you shouldn't expect to find it. That's about it. Would that be a correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. We can only say right now is we've come up with organic material, and it's still very exciting, but we're still in the process of deducing what exactly it is and how does that relate to our archaeological methods and scientific endeavors.
Mm. Bruce, as a longtime pastor, I'm just curious about this. How has your studies, how have your studies in the field of biblical archaeology affected your faith?
Well, I think it's only strengthened my faith. One of the reasons I set off into biblical archaeology was to find some what I call mile markers of things that have come up in archaeology that support the Bible. And, of course, the Dead Sea Scrolls are still kind of a fog to a lot of people. What exactly do they mean? But let me just give you a little idea. Do you remember the concept of the time capsules?
Yes.
To school?
Yeah.
Okay, to me, the Dead Sea Scrolls are God's time capsule. In other words, he took 38 of the 39 books of the Bible and had some men in the 1st and 2nd century B.C. take these Old Testament books and hide them in the caves at Qumran. So if those caves are a time capsule, if you will, they were hidden for 2,000 years, and they weren't discovered until 1947. Between 1947 and 1957, they were archaeologically removed, which I believe is amazing, because if they were found 10 or 20 years before, we didn't have that good of archaeology. But since it was in the 50s, we had some pretty well-renowned archaeologists, one of them being a Catholic named Father DeVoe, and him and a team of archaeologists from all over extracted all these books, turned out to be represented over 900 scrolls, and about 25% of them matched the 38 of the 39 books of the Old Testament. The reason I tell you all this is because when scholars have taken the text and matched it up to the Old Testament today, even the skeptic scholars say it's 95% accurate to the books we carry.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. 2,000-year-old told story that had to be rewritten and rewritten by scribes turns out to be 95% accurate to the Old Testament books we have today. Is that not phenomenal?
I would say almost miraculous.
Yeah. And so it's very exciting. People don't get it. I have talked quite a bit to people about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and once I explain the time capsule concept, they start to understand how God preserved his word so that we could open it up in the 20th century and say, wow, you know, now no one can say that these books have changed in 2,000 years. You know, Jesus' Bible has not changed in 2,000 years. And that's just amazing. You know, no other religion on the planet can even come close to what Christianity has. And if that's not exciting archaeologically, I don't understand where you don't get it. That's just where I'm at. So
no, I
absolutely love biblical archaeology. As Aaron and I could sit and talk to you for hours about all the tell Dan Stelia and what that means, and the Merneptah Stelia, and the, all the other you know, victory stones and what have you that mention Israel in the land of Canaan and in the 13th century B.C. You know, just things that support the Bible. Also, we spend a lot of time refuting the archaeologists who try to use archaeology to say the Bible's not true. Well,
right.
We're on the Bible side saying, well, it is true, and here's our reason. You know, so it's a constant debate. But I'll tell you what, nobody debates the Dead Sea Scrolls. Everybody has to yield to the fact that the, you know, 95% of the Old Testament that you hold in your hands today is accurate for 2,000 years. That is a statement I think should be on the walls of every church in America, every Christian church in America. They should have that up there saying anybody who is an atheist or agnostic or doesn't believe the Bible, God just sealed, you know, through archaeology, put a stamp of approval on his Old Testament being accurate for 2,000 years. It, to me, it's phenomenal. But
No,
people don't get as excited about it as I do, and Aaron does. So.
No, I agree with you, and I think you've just outlined another program that we'll have to do at some point here in the near future, because I taught a class on apologetics to a group of junior and senior high kids at the church that we attended back in St. Louis. This would be about 15 years ago. And that was one of the aspects that I really dug into and was surprised to find how much evidence supposedly that supposedly doesn't exist really exists, documenting the narrative in the Bible. I recently had the opportunity to talk to Timothy Mahoney, who produced and directed the film Patterns of Evidence about the Exodus. And so, you know, this is something I really enjoy talking about. So we'll have to do that at some point. In fact, that was one of the things that came to my mind. I was interviewing a friend, Carl Teichrib, the other night about his experiences out at the Parliament of World Religions a couple of weeks ago in Salt Lake City. All of these various world religions, pagan religions, there were, you know, liberal Judaism, liberal Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, New Agers, Wiccans, even the Grand Mufti of the Great Mosque in Mecca was there. The Imam from the Great Mosque in Mecca was there representing Islam. And all of these groups were together trying to talk about how they could all come together as one. And I just asked Carl, I said, how did you stand it? Because we have the evidence, and the evidence says that they cannot possibly be right. He said, well, you know, I did it so you didn't have to. I was like, well, thank you. God bless you, brother.
Well, that's why, you know, you do not have to twist my arm to get me excited about biblical archaeology, because what came out of the ground speaks volumes compared to whatever the rhetoric is going on around us. And that is that we have the age-old story that has not been changed. I'll tell you what I got excited about. It was the Ebla tablets. Have you heard of those?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, they found in these are governmental documents, and they found the names of the five cities of the plains. The first time outside of the Bible that Sodom and Gomorrah has been mentioned, and they found it at Ebla. And so, you know, to me, that's just wonderful stuff.
No, I agree.
I love finding extra biblical stuff in archaeology that really supports God's word, and you know, that's what it's all about to me.
Yeah, no, I thought it was amazing. Do I remember correctly that at Ebla they also found the name of one of the rulers of that city? This was located in northern Syria, who was named Eber, which is the name of one of Abraham's ancestors.
Yeah, that's where they believe the word Hebrew comes from.
Right. Now, we don't know that that's the same Eber, but at least it documents that the name was in use, which, again, suggests that the biblical account is authentic. Right. So,
exactly. And there's several of those things that, and I'm sure Aaron has some, too, that we have talked about. That, in fact, Aaron and I have been talking about writing our own book about, you know, what is false biblical archaeology and what is rock solid, you know, so that people could know, you know, some of the stuff out there is promoted as good stuff, but it has a lot of, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't have a lot of validity to it.
Right.
But I think every church in America should have a short book on what archaeology is steadfast and true, and what is, you know, more hokey.
That would be a great tool.
Yeah, so that's what us archaeologists talk about. We talk about, you know, what is good to go after, and that's why Aaron and I climbed Mount Ararat. In fact, Aaron summited before I did, and, you know, I'm a little older than Aaron and was not quite in the shape he was. And when I summited, I was dying. I mean, I was hurting bad. And my brother Aaron met me there with a meal to feed me. And I'm forever thankful for that meal. I was worn out, I'm telling you.
Like Esau coming in from the field and getting his bowl of stew, huh?
Exactly. I was absolutely spent. When I showed up at camp and he goes, "Here, Bruce, eat this." And I was like, "I love you." It was just like that, telling you.
Well, Aaron, I know that people wanting to see a movie about finding Noah's Ark are really hoping that the movie's going to reveal that you know, the Ark's been discovered. And I know that that was not the result of this expedition. But what would you hope that people would take away from the account people will see in the movie Finding Noah?
Well, you know, we knew early on that when we began to collaborate with the film team, matter of fact, the director told us that the film can't be about the finding the ark, even though our target area was poured over with all the research and everything we had. The target area was I think probably the best area given that we could reach safely and try to find, and that's where all the convergence of evidence, if you will, was pointing towards the Eastern Plateau. But we knew even at that, you know, the film couldn't be about finding the ark. The film had to be about the men who go and search for the ark. It had to be about the journey. And the journey is, why would a group of intrepid explorers leave their families, step out of the normal roles of life for 2 months, oftentimes without pay, and put their life at risk searching for an unknown at 17,000 feet halfway around the world? That's the story. The story is about a group of men of faith who set out and who overcome every obstacle, every adversity, and bond together as men, a band of brothers that Bruce was talking about. And when your life depends on the next guy, you don't care where that person lives. You don't care what they do. You care that they have your back. And, you know, when Bruce was talking about, you know, when I gave him that hot meal when he summoned it, you are fighting for your life when you are at that altitude. And so you have to depend on each other, and you have to dig down deep, because this goes way beyond any one individual. This is a cause that's greater than yourself. And you really rely on the person next to you. And so, look, I couldn't have ever made it up that mountain had it not been for Bill and Will Hughes. You'll see that it's very evident in the film. But, you know, I have a motto in life: never, ever give up. And you have to dig down deep. But that's the movie. The movie is about the journey. And that's what we wanted to convey to people. And the theme of the movie, Derek, is what's your mountain? Because we know that we all have mountains to climb in our life. There are spiritual mountains that we're all climbing. And you can either do it with help, and sometimes you need help. I needed help getting up that mountain. I couldn't do it by myself. Everything in my body was screaming to turn around. That was the easy thing to do. But we know in life sometimes we can't do that. We have to keep going down that narrow path. That narrow path is hard sometimes. Sometimes you want to sit down and give up. Sometimes you want to get on the sidelines. And it's happened to me. You know, there's a saying in Proverbs that, you know, the righteous falls, you know, seven times, but they get back up, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so that's what the film is about. It's about overcoming obstacles in the journey about the search. So that's what we wanted to convey in the film. And I think the director and the producer did a very, very wonderful job at portraying that. As a matter of fact, we've won Best Documentary at one of the film festivals this year. The Sun and Sand Film Festival won Best Documentary. It's playing again in a couple of other film festivals. But it was the largest documentary release in theatrical history, and we're so blessed and honored to be a part of that.
So how can people see Finding Noah?
Well, it was in theaters back on October 8th, 2015, this year. Fathom, who was our distributor, gave us a one-night release in theaters. It went across 640 theaters across the nation. And so if you missed it, since we're past that date,
right.
We are hoping to have some chances to show it in a large group setting. So we have the opportunity to come to your church, to come to your organization. If you have a large interest in seeing the film, we can bring it to you and have some of our people come, and we can talk about the film. We are set up to do that. We would love to do that over the course of the remaining part of this year and even into next year. We can make that happen, but we need a large group to do it.
Sure.
And then in early 2016, we anticipate the DVD release of Finding Noah, which will have all the extra footage that you didn't see in the 93-minute film. This film went to some 12 different countries and across 15 different states. So there's a lot of footage that will be on the DVD that you won't see in the film. And then it'll go through the normal distribution channels through Netflix and you know, things like that in 2016. So we have a lot of things that is coming in 2016 for Finding Noah.
Very cool. The website to learn more about the film is findingnoah.com. Our guests have been Dr. Aaron Judkins and Bruce Hall, two of the archaeologists that were part of the expedition in 2013 to Mount Ararat. And gentlemen, it's been an education and an honor talking with you, and we'll have to do this again and dig deeper into some of the archaeological evidences that support the biblical narrative.
Thank you, Derek.
I would love to. Thank you for having both of us on. We really appreciate it. And thank you to all the listeners out there who have supported us and the film Finding Noah. We really appreciate your support. This was a grassroots effort and movement, and it takes things like this to send a message to Hollywood that, yes, documentaries can be successful in the Christian community. So we wanted to give a shout-out to all those people who have supported us. And thank you, Derek, for having us on your program, View for the Bunker.
Check the show notes at vftb.net, and that'll get you to the website for the movie Finding Noah. Also, a link to Aaron's website, that is. He's also the host of the Epic Voyages radio program. It's once a month. Sharon and I have been blessed to be a guest on that program. And again, links to those in the show notes, vftb.net, where you will find those. Recording this on November the 1st. And of course, that means we've survived October 31st and Halloween night, the flyby of Asteroid Spooky. Sharon and I talked about that on PID Radio yesterday. We're back to doing PID Radio weekly, by the way. Some shorter programs so that we can fit it into our schedule, but hopefully we've got the workflow down to a pretty efficient routine, so we can get those out on Saturdays going forward. So if you've missed it, we've done the last 3 weeks now at PIDradio.com, and you can subscribe to that with iTunes or Stitcher or any other podcatcher that you might use, just as you do with View from the Bunker. Got links at PIDradio.com to do that. Asteroid Spooky, kind of strange because it wasn't discovered until fairly late in its life, or fairly close to the time that flew past the Earth. And as it got closer, they were able to get a photo of this, astronomers, that is. They found that the reflectivity of this rock, which is officially called 2015 TB-145, was relatively low. The albedo is slightly brighter than your typical comet, which only reflects about 3 to 5% of light. This asteroid reflected about 6% of light from the sun, which is similar to the reflectivity of fresh asphalt. Not exactly what we would think of as shiny, but still, a little more than what you find in your typical comet. But because it wasn't, there was no tail behind it, astronomers have decided that this, rather than an asteroid, is technically a dead comet. So we can call it Comet Spooky, especially because once they got a picture of it, the way it showed in the photo from the National Space Foundation's telescope made it look like a skull. Passed about 1.3 times the distance from the Earth to the Moon within, which is relatively close on astronomical terms. The size of it was enough to make astronomers take notice because it's about three times larger than what they believe hit Tunguska back in, what was it, 1905, 1910? The Tunguska strike just absolutely destroyed about 2,000 square kilometers of forest. 1908, which they say was less than 600 feet in diameter. This thing was about, what was it? That's what I get for not flagging all of the important things. Anyway, about 600 meters across, which roughly 2,000 feet across. So not quite half a mile, between a third and a half a mile in diameter. So it would have made a really big hole if it had hit. So thankfully we didn't have to deal with that. Exorcism Live, the program that I mentioned on the last program, which was the live broadcast from the house in suburban St. Louis, where the events that inspired the movie and the novel The Exorcist took place, as kind of anticipated, really didn't have a lot of excitement. They did the best they could to stage it to try to drum up some excitement during the program, but no spiritual activity, no, essentially a lot of talk, no action. As I predicted, sort of the spiritual equivalent of Geraldo Rivera opening up the tomb or the vault of Al Capone and finding absolutely nothing. Now, the harm in a program like this, of course, is that they spent a couple hours trying to solicit or elicit a response from the spirit realm, which God says is absolutely forbidden. I believe for our own protection, because we're not really equipped to deal with the things that might come through from the other side. So programs like this only encourage other people to try to participate in it, especially when you get somebody who professes to be a Christian, the Archbishop of something called the U.S. United States Old Catholic Church, which is not affiliated with the Roman Catholic Church, went through and did a cleansing of the house or an exorcism of the house. Again, really didn't seem that there was anything there. But as I understand the story of Roland Doe, the pseudonym of the boy who was at the center of the case, the spirits were attached to him, not to the house. So not really much of a surprise there. As far as that goes, kind of an interesting story from Kazakhstan, Central Asia. Space imagery. They've spotted geoglyphs that are believed to be about 8,000 years old and ranging in size from about 300 feet to 1,300 feet across. 1,300 feet, again, about a quarter of a mile. And I hate it when these websites autoplay the videos. Should know by now that anytime you're looking at a laptop and trying to record at the same time, you got to have the sound muted. Some of these symbols that they found from space in Kazakhstan are swastikas. I mean, before the swastika was co-opted by the Nazi Party in the 1930s, it was an ancient symbol. So the curiosity here is that these were previously undiscovered. Researchers don't believe that they were intended to be seen from space, but they're not quite sure what these symbols are supposed to represent. They're created from mounds of dirt about 3 feet high and roughly 30 feet wide. So about 101 raised mounds in this area. And again, one of the structures at this site in Kazakhstan, apparently a swastika, very ancient symbol. Who inspired them to put it there, and why were they building these things at in some cases, we're up to a quarter of a mile across? Curious. New election in Turkey. We'll take a look at that tomorrow on Skywatch TV as we try to figure out the geopolitical impact of what's going on there. Once again, the government of President Tayyip Erdogan trying to solidify control over the government so he can remain in power. Trying to do in Turkey, I guess, what Vladimir Putin did in Russia, which is kind of game the system so that he could remain in power. You know, the president is term limited in Russia, and so he basically had the constitution rewritten so that he could run as president for a second term with an intermediate period in which he served as the prime minister under Medvedev. But everybody pretty much knew that Putin was still the guy in charge. So Erdogan seems to be trying to do the same thing in Turkey. And, of course, the situation in Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, just getting more and more complex. So we'll keep an eye on that as we go forward. There was an event that took place here in the United States a couple of weeks ago, and thankfully we had boots on the ground. Carl Teichrib, editor of Forcing Change, the excellent online journal at forcingchange.org, was at the Parliament of World Religions in Salt Lake City a couple of weeks ago, and he will report on what he saw there on our next program, because, you know, somehow you got a group of people who represent religions that make mutually exclusive truth claims all coming together and saying that somehow, some way, they'll find a way to all work together because ultimately we're all on the same path to God. Even the Christians who were there basically made that claim. And of course, as a Christian, you can't really get around the statement by Jesus that I am the way, the truth, and life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. So we're sorry. While we desire to live in peace with our brothers and sisters who are Hindu or Buddhist or Jain or Zoroastrian or Wiccan or Jewish, Muslim, Mormon, whatever. You know, Jesus made an exclusive truth claim there. And you cannot have that be true and also all of these other religions true at the same time. So Carl, God love him, went there, spent 5 days at this event without his head exploding from the sheer illogic of it all, and he'll report on that, and you'll hear that on our next program, which will be uploaded Wednesday night, God willing, November the 4th. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, concluded the book of Deuteronomy today. That is now posted at gilberthouse.org. It was our 50th study, as we've been doing this now for over a year, and we've gotten through the Pentateuch, plus the book of Job. So we're going through the Bible chronologically, and today we get to some really key passages from Deuteronomy chapter 32, fundamental to understanding the cosmology of, well, not just the ancient Israelites, but really Christian cosmology as well, and why the divine counsel concept is not polytheism. So that is the most recent study posted at gilberthouse.org. They're there, they're archived, and they're available for you to download at your convenience at no charge. GilbertHouse.org for the Gilbert House Fellowship, our weekly Bible study. This week on Skywatch TV, we begin the first of a couple interviews about the forthcoming documentary film Inhuman. It is finally done. Gans Shimura has done a fantastic job of editing the film and getting it to the duplicator. And it is now in the process of being copied. So those will be available as of November 17th. Inhuman, the film, Tom Horn, Sharon Gilbert, and myself, the next 2 weeks on Skywatch TV, talking about the transhumanist movement. Skywatch TV airs at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 p.m. Central Time on the Christian Television Network. If you have satellite TV, that's Dish Network 267, DirecTV Channel 376. It's also on the Glory Star satellite, channel 117. And if you don't have satellite TV, you can watch it on the Christian Television Network's website. They have a live web stream at ctnonline.com. Again, that's Tuesday night, 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 Central Time, which would be UTC-5, UTC-6, now that we're back on standard time here in the United States. And, of course, also available later in the week on the Skywatch TV channel on YouTube and Roku. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.